taking the soft limit. And I'll show you how to recover the soft theorems. And in the end, I'll go to four dimension. So to make connection with all this spinner helicity and hopefully also, you know, the lead you to the, through twister string, I will lead you to the Grassmannian picture. Just give you an idea that lots of even nicer things happen in 4D. So let's just review the conclusion we reached yesterday, which there are some classes of theories whose tree level S matrices have very simple formula in terms of scattering equations. So they actually roughly can be divided into three classes. Each of them has this this relations among them. So the first class, we start from Einstein's gravity, or more precisely the graviton coupled to dilaton and the B field system. And if you take a dimensional reduction here, you reach at Einstein-Maxwell theory, just graviton together with photons. Or if you do it on both sides, you can actually get Einstein-Maxwell scalar theory. And I told you that there's a way, although I didn't explain how, but this would take a lot of time, to make this photon non-abelian, such that you actually reach at the theory that you have young mu's minimally coupled to Einstein gravity, that I call Einstein young mu's here. This is the theory of graviton with gluons. And this will be the most general theory in this class. It has two coupling constants. It has a G Newton and it has a G young mu's. So now if you take this G Newton to zero, you recover a theory that is pure young mu's, right? The graviton decouple. If you take G young mu's to zero, the gluon doesn't completely decouple, but they become photons. They don't have self-interaction, but they can still interact through graviton. So that's how you go back to Einstein-Maxwell. So this is the first class of theory. Now you can also start with young mu's, with this theory. You do this exactly the same thing if you do dimensional reduction. I showed you that there's very trivial to do that. You arrive at this young mu scalar theory, which is the low energy effective field theory of the D-brains that you obtain string theory. And you can make this scalars non-abelian by adding a UN group to it. UN cross UN. The UN color group is already there for the scalars, but you add another UN tilde flavor group to the scalar to make it self-interacting. That is adding a cubic interaction term. And you obtain this most general theory in this class, which is so-called generalized young mu scalar theory. It's the standard one with another cubic non-abelian interaction vertices. And this theory has two coupling constants, G young mu's associated with the UN, and now this new coupling constant lambda prime, say. Oh, just lambda. That is the term I added, right? I mean, this lambda with F and F tilde 3 phi. This is the coupling. Anyway, so now you can start to play with this theory, and you say you send the G young mu's to zero. What do we recover? You throw away, all the gluons become decoupled, but the scalars are still there and they interact exactly through this. This is the first theory introduced in our lecture, actually. This is a bi-adjoint phi cube theory, right? So you have a structure constant from UN, a structure constant from UN tilde, and the scalars just interact through this vertices. Or you can send lambda to zero. And again, the scalar doesn't really decouple. They just interact through the gluons. And this is, you recover the standard young mu scalar theory. The third class is a bit weird. I didn't give you proper, so these are all very simple. I mean, I give you these formulas for gravity or young mu's or bi-adjoint scalar, and I told you that how they are related to these more general theories. At least I told you this dimension reduction step, and there's also this non-abelian, the step of making a non-abelian. But these theories, I only tell you how to get them by mix and match, because we found another building block called Pfaffian prime A. And this is a new building block you want to use to build more formulas that describe some some S matrix of some new theory. And it turns out there are this theory of DBI type. I give you a formula for Born-Ingfeld, and if you do dimensional reduction, of course you get DBI, Dirac-Born-Ingfeld. This is only photon. This has photon coupled to photon scalars. Now there's actually a theory that I didn't mention, and actually this theory is still kind of mysterious even today. I mean, half a year after we write down its S matrix and the conjecture for its Lagrangian, we still don't know whether it appears somewhere or it's, you know, has some other relevance in other contexts. But it has two coupling constants. It has a lambda prime, which is the coupling constant for a nonlinear second model that I introduced yesterday, and a length coupling, which is the coupling for DBI. So this theory has the photon and the scalars, but the scalars are now non-abelian. They have its own UN flavor group. So if you take the photon away, if you send this L to zero, actually you reach at the theory we started yesterday. I mean, in this weird class, we started with this UN nonlinear second model that doesn't have photon, only scalars, and the scalars are flavored under a UN group, right? The single trace theory. But if you turn off this interaction of lambda prime, which is the interaction, the coupling for nonlinear second model, you recover this DBI theory, where you still have the scalars, but they interact through the photons. Okay, so I hope it's clear. And here, also you can apply the same operation we applied to our formula to make scalar or photon to be non-abelian. Here you also make the scalar non-abelian. So this is still an interesting theory that, to our knowledge, has not been studied before. We found a very nice formula for its tree-level S matrix. It seems to be, at least it's classically consistent and everything. And I also told you there are some relations between these three classes of theories. Let me use another color. So, namely, there's this KLT relation for their tree-level amplitude. So let me just remind you, what is a KLT relation? If you take any theory in this class, because you notice that this class always have a UN color group, so you can do color decomposition. If you take any partial amplitudes here, you do a KLT bilinear with Yamil's theory, you recover any theory, the corresponding theory here. If you do a KLT bilinear with nonlinear second model, with the partial amplitudes of nonlinear second model, you reach at the corresponding theory here. And in both sides, they are, you know, the result of your KLT. So in other words, if you have a, in this theory, if you have a amplitude that can be written as a Park-Taylor times I right, say I left, which is half integrand. And if you take the Yamil's case as your I right, well, if you take another theory that has this, this is what I told you about KLT. And then if you do KLT of them, what you get is another theory. Now it has a tree amplitude of the form with I left, the integrand being given by I left and I right. This is the so-called KLT operation in our formula level. Okay, so there's this. At least this direction is quite mysterious, that we don't have a string theory interpretation why the amplitudes in this class, when you KLT them with, double copy them with nonlinear circle model, you reach theories in this. And you can do actually one step more. If you take the nonlinear circle model and do it with yourself, KLT it with itself, you get this special Galilean theory. That's a theory of scalars with even higher derivative. Okay, so this is all the simple, all the theories that's been studied so far that has very simple scattering equation formulas. And actually, there are also some progress of putting fermions here. So you can imagine to have Yamil's 12 gauge theory interacting with at least adjoint fermions. You put it here, and when you do dimension reduction, of course, it gives you the full supersymmetric theory when you reach lower dimension. So that's basically all the theories that have been studied. And there's a very simple reason why these theories have simple scattering equation formula. So it's either due to the gauge invariance of gluons or gravitons, or it's due to this non-linearly realized symmetry that you can see from soft scalar limit. This will explain in detail later. So if the theory has only scalars, then it's the second reason. If it has particles with spin, it's the first reason. Because this both symmetry, gauge symmetry, or this nonlinear realized symmetry cannot be seen from individual Feynman diagram. So if you tweak this theory a little bit, such that it doesn't have gauge symmetry or nonlinearly realized symmetry. For example, if you add some more term to your nonlinear circle model to break this symmetry, then the Feynman diagram will not add up to give you some nice enhanced soft limit, or not add up to give you a gauge invariant object. So that means there's something special about all these theories that they share. They have either this symmetry or this symmetry, and which is the explanation why it's scattering equation formula is so simple. Because I've shown you that at least in the gravity Yamuse case, the appearance of this Fafian is really to tell you that you want to make gauge invariance manifest. And also you'll see very soon that the appearance of this Fafian prime A object, some power of Fafian prime A object. This is the analog of Fafian prime psi for the gluon or graviton case. This is analog for them in the scalar case. This really makes the soft scalar limit very manifest. And that's the reason behind this theory, you know, nonlinear circle model, DBI, or special Galilean to be very simple S matrix. Okay. So, yeah.
So, all of this is independent of the space-time background, right? Just
these are all written down in flat space, if you want, around the Minkowski. Flat space, yeah.
Right, but the formulation starting with scattering equations, does that depend on the space-time background to get theories, or?
What do you mean?
If you start with kinematic invariants and scattering equations.
But that's your S matrix is only defined if you have asymptotic flat space. Yeah. Otherwise, it's.
But asymptotically flat is enough for.
I won't say that this. For example, I don't know how to apply this to compute anything ADS. I won't know how to do that. Yeah. More questions? Okay, so I'll start today's lecture by teach you a little bit about the soft limit. So this serves as two purposes. The first is that it's a way to, you'll see a bit later that by studying the soft limit of a scattering equation and the formula, you will be able to see Weinberg's soft theorem and also this soft scalar theorems in a very manifest way. And this is by far, I know, the most interesting way to see it, because it directly gives you Weinberg's this universal soft behavior in a very suggestive form. But as right now, we'll also see the soft limits as a way to count or get, depending on how hard you try, the solutions. So as I promised in the earlier lecture, I need to tell you why scattering equation always has n minus 3 factorial solutions. And this is actually, by studying soft limit, is the easiest way to see it. And also using that fact that you can most easily obtain a solution to scattering equation in the soft limit is a way to actually obtain general solutions. And that's actually how we solve them in practice when you go to high enough number of points. Okay, so what is the soft limit? Here you just take a single particle, see the nth particle. You take its momentum to be soft. Let's put a parameter epsilon and still call the direction q mu, and you want to take epsilon to zero, such that the momentum of that particle become very soft. And other particles still has hard momentum. Now, what happens in this soft limit to our scattering equation? So if you look at the EA, that A runs from 1 to n minus 1, actually, let's write it down. So B different from A. And let's split the sum into two parts. First part is B runs from 1 to a minus 1, B different from A. And there's another term that is KA dot KN, right? B equals N term. So we want this to be 0. This is the scattering equation for, yeah, let me just write it this way. EA, where A equals 1, 2 to N minus 1. That's the first N minus 1 equation. And note that this term is solved, right? So this is just epsilon KA dot Q. And all other terms are order 1. This term can be dropped. So basically, the equation becomes a n minus 1 point system. This is a system of n minus 1 point equations, right? Because Zn and Kn drop in all the equations, okay? Up to higher ordering epsilon. We only go to leading order now. Now let's look at the last equation, En. So this one is a non-trivial thing happens. So you have Kn dot Kb of Zm minus Zb from B from 1 to N minus 1. And although this Kn is solved, all the term has the same order, right? So you can just pull out this epsilon and write it as Q dot Kb. This is a non-trivial equation. Note. This bracket equals 0 is still a non-trivial equation that you want to solve. It's unlike here, you can just drop this term and then you become an n minus 1 point system. This is an additional one equation that's non-trivial. So how do you proceed here? You can first try to solve this n minus 1 point system that say you have a way to solve them. You obtain some number of solutions. For Z, so Zn already decoupled. So this will give you some solutions for Z1, Z2, all the way to Zn minus 1. Right? We can obtain solutions for these variables. Now, for each solution here, once you obtain any one of the solutions here, you can plug it in to the last equation. Now, the last equation will become an equation for Zn, right? Because all the other Zs are already known from solving those equations. So now you view this equation En equals 0 really as an equation for Zn, you want to solve it. Let's see what kind of equation is this. So we can pull out all the denominators. We write this product B from 1 to n minus 1. And then let's look at what's in this bracket. So you will see that there will be a first term that looks like Q dot Kb summing over B times Zn to what power? Because you collect all the denominator. Originally, there are n minus 1 term, and if you collect all of them, this is n minus 2 power, right? Agree? This is the first term that the bracket becomes a polynomial now in terms of Zn. And the second term is like this. You have maybe a minus sign. B from 1 to n minus 1, Q dot Kb, Zb, this whole thing, times Zn to the n minus 3 power. And then you have the one more term as a polynomial. So this is just rewriting it in terms of polynomial form of Zn. So as we said, we already solved Z1 to Zn minus 1. And for each solution, we plug it here. We want to study this polynomial in terms of Zn. So naively, we say, oh, this is a degree n minus 2 polynomial. But note that this guy is actually 0. The coefficient of the highest term is 0. And what's the reason? It's momentum conservation. So sum over B from 1 to n minus 1 gives you Kn back. Kn dot Q is 0. Okay. So this is actually a degree n minus 3 polynomial for Zn. Right? So we want to solve an equation for Zn that's a degree n minus 3 polynomial. So for each solution you found here, for Z1 through Zn minus 1, you plug it in, how many solutions will you find? You'll find n minus 3 solutions for generic kinematics. I mean, if not, no nothing singular happen. You will find n minus 3 solutions for Zn, for every solution of Z1 through Zn minus 1 when you solve this system, right? So this actually gives you a counting. So the number of solution for n point, so let's just call this number of solution pound of n, is actually given by the number of solution of n minus 1 point system. For each of them, you find n minus 3 solutions. So this equation actually holds at the solved limit, right? Or very close to the solved limit, you can see. And actually, when you start to increase epsilon, the epsilon can go from, say, 0 to 1. When it's 0, you're at the solved point. When you increase it to 1, it's a normal kinematic point you start with. When you do that smooth move of epsilon, the number of solutions should not jump. So that's how you argue, that's how you prove actually the number of solutions always goes like that. So even when you go away from soft limit to a generic kinematic point, the number of solutions always goes back. And I showed you that the number of solutions for 4 point is 1. Okay, so this just tells you the number of solution must be n minus 3 factorial for any generic kinematics without, you know, if it's not singular or anything. And actually, there's a way to rewrite our scattering equation directly in terms of some polynomial equation of degree n minus 3 factorial. It's quite complicated, but there is a way to do that. And this is why you always have this number of solutions. Okay, is it clear? I think it's very crucial that you have this momentum conservation such that this only a degree n minus 3 polynomial for Zn. Yeah, and this turns out actually also a very, so yeah, let me even explain a little bit further. When you have 4 point, as I said, you already found one solution, right? Now you want to study 5 point scattering equation. What do? You take the fifth particle to be solved such that you go back to your 4 point kinematics, still has momentum conservation and everything. You find that solution for Z1 to Z4, okay? And now you plug into the fifth scattering equation, which is a degree 2 equation for Z5. You solve it, you found two solutions for Z5. And now you found two solutions to your whole system. And now you start to increase epsilon. These two solutions still go, you know, each of them still grow, like become some more generic solution, but there are still always these two. So always there are two, I don't remember if I give you the exercise, you can really study the 5 point scattering equation to turn it into a quadratic equation, and you found that there are two solutions. But these are all, I mean, in practice, if you want to solve this scattering equation numerically, you can do it, say, with Mathematica, just use nsolve. You will find that you won't have any problem for up to 7 point. I mean, I'm very bad with this numeric thing, so that's the only thing I tried. Starting 8 point, I run into problem. I ask it to solve, you know, essentially I'm asking my laptop to solve a degree 120 polynomial equation, and it complains, or it doesn't give me anything. So what should I do? I cannot get a numeric solution to the 8 point system. What you do is you just first take the solved limit and go back to your 7 point system. And now you start to increase epsilon. You literally do this iteration procedure on your computer to ask it to solve at every step. So more precisely, say let's do a very practical practical way of solving the equations, scattering equations. So you can really just do the following. Let's prepare some Sij, well, I and j goes from 1 to n minus 1, except the last one, Sn minus 2 n minus 1, is given by the sum of the rest. So this is one way to realize momentum conservation. Very trivially, you just give random number. I mean, I will always choose some rational number to this, because in the end, I want to recover my answer as a rational function of them, which will be a rational number. So you give some rational number to this Mandelstams, and remember there's this last one that's given by the sum of the rest. And this is only concern n particles. So the last particle, Sn, so Sin, can also be given by this momentum conservation of Sij, j from 1 to m as well, right? So this is a way that once you prepare these guys, you get all the Mandelstam you want. And now you really plug it into your scattering equation. You do n solve. Up to 7 particles, at least in my laptop, it's okay. And if you have more particles, you need to use this trick. So how do we use this trick? Let's just write very, say we, okay, let's do this gauge fixing of z1 goes to infinity. And for example, z2, z3, you fix them to be 0, 1. Doesn't really matter. If you do that, then all your, we eliminated these 3 variables and also the first 3 equations. So what you really solve are these equations, SAB, ZA minus ZB, B different from A, equals 0, and A goes from 4, 5, all the way to N, right? We eliminated the first 3. We want to solve this. And let's put actually some epsilon A, epsilon B here. And what do they do? So these epsilons, they run either, they take the value of either 1 or 0. If A is goes from 1 to 7, that's simply because of the ability of my computer, you can adjust it, then it's 1. If A is 8 to N, it's 0, okay? So if you do that, and you already obtain, you solve this system, you already obtain a softer, multi-soft limit of an n-particle system down to 7 particles. And you can obtain the solution, the 24 solutions. 24 solutions for 7 particles using, say, n-soft. If you have, you know, you can take it to very high precision, and in the end, you can get your amplitude precisely, not to any error, because you can recover amplitude as a rational number by rationalize or some other way of doing that. Okay, so you can solve this. Now you want to go to n particle, not just 7 particle. What do? You start to divide your epsilon to some interval, you know, you do it m steps. So every time your epsilon will be increased by 1 over m. And by doing that, you can still solve your scattering equation as I just described approximately. You can use this front root, for example, which is very close to your original solved point. You can find root. And then you will find n minus 3, say at 7-point case, for each of the 24 solutions, you will find 5 more solutions when you start to do this iteration. And if you increase this integer m, you can get it more precise. So by doing that, for example, we can easily solve the scattering equation system for 15 particles if you give me a bunch of data as this Sij. And then what do you do? After you solve the equation, say you want to solve n gluon scattering, okay? And say n is 15. You give me this kinematic data. I already told you the formula is this determinant of this scattering equation derivative matrix that I deleted 1, 2, 3, for example. I already deleted 1, 2, 3. And then I put a Park-Taylor here. But remember, z1 is infinity, so it cancels that. I can remove it by canceling the Fadeev Popov Jacobian, if you still remember from our first Wednesday's lecture. And then this Fafian guy of this matrix that depends on epsilon and k and z, that I delete 1, 2, and 1, 2. So this is actually a precise formula that you can use to compute n gluon scattering. Once you obtain all the solutions, right? Once I obtain all the solutions, I plug it in, z1 to zn, actually z3 to zn, because z4 to zn, because z1, z2, z3 are fixed. They are the solutions. So you do this. If you have high enough precision, you get a number to very high digits, and then you rationalize it. It actually gives you some precise answer in terms of this is numeric, but there's no error in the end. You get a rational number. This is how you compute this. And the one big advantage of this formalism is something funny, that if you are given a task that you want to use it to compute lots of amplitudes, you're not just n gluon scattering, but say n graviton, you want to do them all at the same time, then you only need to solve the scattering equation once, because these solutions are universal, right? So if I mean, you probably won't be given such a task, but if you really want to do it, once you solve the scattering equation for 15 particles, 15 massless particles, it doesn't really care what particles are they. You can use them to plug into some formula to get you what you want. And so some people have been asking what's the efficiency of this, you know, as a numeric way of solving amplitude. So basically for color order amplitude, it definitely not as efficient as BCFW that you learned. But for gravity, actually, as I said, I'm very bad with this numerics, so I didn't really do a fair comparison. But say I ask Alice and also Jake to do this. Actually, it's in their check, it's even quicker than doing BCFW for gravity. You know, for theories without the color ordering that you can strip off. So basically, if your theory already has many diagrams, when you do BCFW, it has a factorial increase of number. So it's better to just solve the scattering equation to get n minus 3 factorial solutions and then plug it in. It's very efficient for doing those things. Okay, so this is really first application of starting to solve the limit of the system, that you can really use it to solve the system, not just add the solve the limit, but also for more generic. So we actually discussed it in our paper. If you're interested, we can discuss it more, how to apply it in practice. So the second application of this soft limits is I want to talk about the soft theorems. I mean, some people may know it as Weinberg soft theorem, but as I said, many people contribute to this subject. So this is very, very important property of your amplitude, because they are very universal soft, they describe universal soft behavior of your amplitude. And for example, in Weinberg's case, it gives you the for the soft graviton case, it can be used as a way to show equivalence system, equivalence principle for the graviton case, and also it tells you the conservation of charge if you study soft photons. And for example, there cannot be consistent higher spin propagations by studying the soft behavior of your amplitudes. Okay, so there are of course many different ways of doing that. Weinberg did it using like Feynman diagram argument, but here we want to see it again from our formula, because I think this is a very nice way of seeing how the formula directly hands you a soft factor on the. So it's basically a one-line argument that the formula gives you a soft factor based on the solutions, based on the soft limit of the equation I just discussed. And then by Rafu theorem, this soft factor on the solution space breaking to a sum over hard particles, which is the usual way of writing down the universal soft factor. Okay? So in any case, I just find this very illuminating to write this proof for you. So in general, as I showed, if you take this soft limit of one of the particle, our endpoint equation becomes n minus one point equations plus one additional, plus one more, and that one more is an equation for Zn. It's a degree n minus three polynomial equation for Zn. Okay, so this means in formula level, if you remember, our amplitude is written as an integral of say the last particle with this last scattering equation. And it's given by this, right? So this is the measure for the remaining n minus one particle, and this is the last particle. Okay, you can just write them, separate them this way. And I haven't told you anything about the integrand. This depends on the theory, but this is just a kinematic level what happened. You do this split. And something nice about all these theories is that both in the case of soft gluon, soft graviton, And later I will talk about soft scalars. This integrand also factorized nicely under the soft limit. So let's just take the gravity case. We know the gravity case, the integrand is just a determinant of a matrix psi that I introduced some time ago. It's just this A, B, C, and where here you have K dot K. Here you have, say, epsilon dot K. And here you have epsilon dot epsilon, this matrix, if you still remember it. So the integrand is simply the determinant of this, reduced determinant of this. And now, how do we compute the determinant? Of course, we can expand it along the nth column and row, right? I mean, this is an anti-symmetric matrix, so you expand it as along the nth column is the equivalent as expanding along the nth row. So every term, note, on the nth row is proportional to Kn, which is the soft particle that we're taking to be soft, except one term. Can you remember which term is not? It's the CNN term, this diagonal piece of the C matrix. So every term is proportional, every term is order epsilon, except the CNN is actually order one. So what is the form of the CNN? Let me remind you, because it's proportional K, epsilon N, not KN, dot with KB, ZM and ZB, summing over B from 1 to N minus 1. So this term CNN is of course only order, is order 1, unlike all other terms is order epsilon. So when you do this expansion along the nth column and the row, you actually get only one contribution at leading order. So this is very nice. In the soft limit, this becomes CNN squared of a determinant of N minus 1 particle object. So you deleted nth column and row, you recover the at 1. And this square is because you're dealing with anti-symmetric matrix. You're expanding along both column and row. Okay? So this is really behind the reason. I mean, all this integrand has this property that when you take soft limit, it becomes some N minus 1 point integrand times some object. And this is actually the soft factor in our solution space. And it will turn into the soft factor of the physical amplitude when we do the next manipulation. Okay, so this is for the gravity case, I show you explicitly what happened. So how do we proceed? Basically what we said is that the n graviton scattering amplitude now looks like this. Which is just determinant prime of N minus one particle system. So note what I did. I factor out the CNN because it depends on ZN, and everything else doesn't depend on ZN now, right? As I said, this equation already has the ZN drop in all this N minus one point equation. So that's why it's a d mu N minus one. Now the integrand after we factor out CNN square is actually also only depends on N minus one particles. And that's the N minus 1 integrand. So this is the first result we get. Indeed, you get some universal operator, a universal object, depending on the nth soft particle, acting on your amplitude. This is the amplitude of your N minus 1 hard particles. Okay? And also note I made some rewriting here, which is equivalent to this, because instead of viewing it as a one-dimensional integral localized by a delta function, it's better to actually look at it as a contour integral where you enclose the contour of this guy going to zero. So the contour is that this En is very close to zero. Okay, so this is really, I mean, you should really view scattering equation formula like that. You're taking all this n delta functions, n minus 3 delta functions, they are the contour you want to take. Now what's the next step? So this already tells you there's a soft theorem because it's n minus 1 particle and something acting on it. But this something is still in the solution space with the last equation having been solved. So it gives you a sum over n minus 3 solution to the last equation, but they are not the usual way we see. So now we do a residue theorem, actually. Instead of hitting this pole, you hit in the, you hit all other poles of this formula with respect to Zn. Then some nice thing happened. And you may ask, what are the poles here? Because this guy doesn't depend on Zn anymore. So all the poles are in this Cnn square. Unfortunately, I erased it. So Cnn, let me remind you again, Cnn square is just this b from 1 to n minus 1, epsilon n dot kb, Zn minus Zb square. Okay? So you hit all these poles. All these poles. So they are exactly having the interpretation of Zn. So the soft factor after you do a residue theorem will become all the residues where your Zn hit one of the hard particles. So that formula in the soft limit is simply become a summing over other residues with a minus sign of a contour integral of the Zn. And you still have this guy here, but you don't hit it. You deform the contour such that you don't hit it. And you hit all the poles of Zn minus Zb squared with epsilon n dot kb squared. You hit all these poles. This is your new contour. And what is the result? You just extracted the, also times the n minus 1 particle amplitude. And the result is very simple. It's just a summing over b from 1 to n minus 1. You extract the coefficient of this. For each term, it has an epsilon n dot kb squared and only a kn dot kb, no square, in the denominator. That's the residue of your every one of your term. This whole thing times the n minus 1 particle, n minus 1 graviton scattering. Okay, so this is how you see soft theorem by simply doing this residue theorem. And this is the so-called soft factor of graviton for nth graviton, first found by Weinberg. So you can actually check that this factor is gauge invariant. If you replace epsilon n by kn, you cancel one power, and after the sum, it's because of momentum conservation. This is a gauge invariant object. Okay? So, this is one way to our way of seeing Weinberg's soft theorem. You can do the same thing for Young Mills, except now you don't have this determinant prime. You only have a Pfaffian, and you only when you do a soft limit, you don't have Cnn squared, only one copy of Cnn, and also you have a Park-Taylor. Say we consider the canonical ordering, and you just I leave this as an exercise if you. Still in the mood of doing it the last day. You just write it as Zn. I mean, this I already showed you when I tried to show the U1 decoupling and so on, right? So the Park-Taylor factor can be written as the n minus 1 Park-Taylor factor times the difference of these two terms. Okay? But the exercise is that to use this and to use the similar relation for Young Mills integrand that Pfaffian goes to Cnn times n minus 1 point Pfaffian. To use this, call it 1 and this is 2. To use 1 and 2 to show the so-called soft gluon theorem. It's a theorem again writing m gluon amplitude in the soft limit as n minus 1 gluon amplitude times some soft factor. You will find that soft factor. And the soft factor is exactly because of this color ordering, the soft particle only talks to its two neighboring ones. So it's two term. Unlike in the graviton case, it's a summing over n minus 1 or the hard particle. Okay, so I won't say much about this Young-Mills case. I'll leave it as an exercise. And also, the last thing I want to say is that not only for soft graviton or gluons, you can also do soft scalars. And in that case, you don't see a soft theorem if you consider a single soft scalar. Rather, you just see the amplitude vanishes. And that's exactly that's exactly equivalent of saying there's a nonlinear realized symmetry. If you take the soft scalar, parameterize your coset. And if the scalars are parameterizing your cosine. If you take one of them to be solved, the amplitude vanishes. And this is something also you can very easily show. And how do you show that? Just know that these are the case we want to consider nonlinear signal model, the pure Skinner case of DBI, and then this special Galileo. So for this case, nonlinear signal model, DBI, and the special Galileo, we want to study soft scalar theorem because they have scalar in it. So again, you take the soft limit, everything else is the same, except the integrand now is different. Instead of this Fatim prime psi, you have Fatim prime of A. Okay? So these three guys actually have 2 power of Fatim prime A, 3 power of Fatim prime A, and 4 power of Fatim prime A, if you remember from yesterday's talk. Other things, multiplying them with Fatim X and so on, they are just kinematic independent. Okay? So the only thing you need to show is that this guy goes like order epsilon a square, order epsilon cube, and order epsilon to the fourth. So this is the only scaling behavior you need to know, right? Each Fatim prime A is like order epsilon. It's very similar to this expansion that I discussed then. And remember, you pull out a kn dot kb in the denominator as your contour, as the pole to do your contour integral. So you have a 1 over epsilon here, right? This kn is epsilon q, if you remember. So you have a 1 over epsilon there. So that's how you see the soft behavior of this three, of these three theories, order epsilon, order epsilon square, and order epsilon cube. So this is again a one-line proof of the theory having vanishing single scalar soft limit, which is the indication of the nonlinear realized symmetry of these theories. Okay? You can now study two soft theorems to really explore this, the algebra of this symmetry. But that's the only thing I want to say here. They have, and also very importantly, this is the analog of the gauge invariance, that the soft scalar of the amplitude vanishes. It's never manifest from Feynman diagram. Each Feynman diagram you look at it, you can look at the Feynman diagram of this theory. They're very simple, they're just scalar diagrams. But if you take one particle to be soft, you find that they're never so strong. So individual Feynman diagrams. And only when you add them together, just as in the case of Yamil's gravity, you recover gauge invariance, here you recover the fact that the soft scalar limit vanishes. Okay, so these are everything I want to talk about, the soft limits and soft theorems. The next, are there any questions? No? Okay, so the next thing I want to discuss is the reduction to 4D. I think it's very interesting because although all this formalism works in general dimension, but in 4D there are something very special happened, and then also further simplifications for Yamil's or gravity and various theories. You will recover Wheaton's twisted string formula, and from there it's actually very, from our derivation of the Wheaton's twisted string formula from that formula, from the scattering equation formula in general dimension, you will be, it's actually very easy to see there's a Grassmannian structure. That's the last thing I want to comment on, at least just for tree amplitude. Okay, so how do we see this reduction to 4D in an easy way? Actually, I'll provide you with another derivation of scattering equation. I mean, I didn't really give you a derivation of scattering equation before. I give you some motivation that they come from naturally from this idea of making Park-Taylor-like correlator to satisfy BCG relation. Then you require a scattering equation. But there's a more proper way of deriving them, if you want, because we learned from Wheaton's idea that if you have a Riemann sphere, the Wheaton's twisted string is really, you have this Riemann sphere at tree level, it maps to a target space of this CP3, which is the, you can just regard it as equivalent to our space of lambda and lambda tilde, this spinner space, this is equivalent, this twisted space. But the key is that you really want to have a map, and it's a rational map, meaning that it actually, in Wheaton's case, it's a polynomial map, but it doesn't matter. You can divide by some denominator. But you only want to have rational map for punctures on this Riemann sphere, which you have z1 to zn, to map to some target space that you have lambda and lambda tilde. Okay? And what is this target space in 4D? It's actually the light cone of your momentum space. So this is the key message we want to learn from Wheaton. that you start from a sphere with punctures, you map it into the null comb of momentum space. In 4D, it happens to be that this null comb can be written as a twister space, right? But in general dimension, we don't have that. So let's just stick to this idea. So we want to construct a rational map, say omega mu of z, to satisfy two conditions. The first one is that it should map each point z1 to zn, say za. It should map each point to the momentum you have, right? So we have this omega mu, which is a vector valued map from your Riemann sphere to the momentum space. So if you do a counter integral of each z around this puncture, you really want this map to give you the external momentum Ka, right? So this means there's a theorem saying that this can be written like the following. The only solution is this. So this is the map we want to consider. Okay? It's a linear combination of z minus za for n particles, and each of them has coefficient Ka. This guarantees you that you get this.
I'm sorry, could you repeat, what is this W?
This is a map from CP1 to Minkowski space. To be determined, a rational map. And we require two things. One is it maps each puncture into the external momenta, the corresponding external momenta, and it actually gives you the unique form. But there's a second requirement that's very important, because I don't want this map to just go to the general Minkowski space, this momentum space. I actually want it to go to the null comb of the momentum space. So actually omega mu of z has to be lifelike. So this is the second condition. This omega cannot just map into arbitrary point in the momentum space, but it has to map into the life comb. So here, note there's a further advantage of this form, that it doesn't have a pole at infinity. So no pole at infinity. Because if you compute its residue at infinity, what is it? The residue of z at infinity of this omega mu of z is simply the sum of the n particles, which is zero, right, by momentum conservation. So the fact that you have momentum conservation data, conserve the momenta, mean that your map has no pole at infinity. Now, it has to map into this light comb, and what is this function? This function is exactly Ka dot Kb over z minus za, z minus zb. So this is this. I'm writing it down for you. With the summation a and b both go from 1 to n, right? You can check this, probably with a 2 in front. So saying that I want this guy to map to light comb, that omega mu to map to light comb, is saying that this function has to vanish. And there's a very simple requirement that this has to vanish means that there's no simple pole, because there's no pole at infinity. So actually, it only requires no simple pole and no double pole, right? So let's look at the double pole. Sorry, this is a bracket. The double pole is where A equals B, the diagonal term. The requirement that is no double pole means Ka squared equals zero for A from 1 to n. That is a consistency check, right? You want your external data to be massless. And if your omega map to the light cone, of course, when z equals za, they have to be also on the light cone. But something very nice happened now for the condition of no simple pole. If you look at the residue of a simple pole z goes to za, what is the residue? The residue of this object at z equals za is nothing but scattering equation. So you have a summation b different from a, ka dot kb, za minus zb equals zero. Okay. So this finishes our derivation. So viewed in this way, we have done nothing more than just using Witten's idea of This is not the original way we found these equations, but this is later we found that this is a more proper way to interpret that. If you want to build a map on a sphere to the light cone of a momentum space, then these punctures cannot be random. They have to satisfy this condition. This is a consistency condition for you to be able to build such a map. So if you want to build a map from sphere to the light cone, all your z's have to satisfy this constraint. So scattering equations are nothing but the constraints that you want to build such a map. And indeed, Witten realized in 4D that you have to, this is what you need to do, right? You need to build a map to the twister space or the light cone. Okay, so now you also see something very special for 4D, right? So in general dimension, this is all you can say. Let's look at the lifelike condition and they translate to scattering equation. But in 4D, you can do more. You can write down this lifelike condition in a spinner form. So that is why you can go to something more special than just writing down the general scattering equations. So let's actually introduce this P mu map simply as a polynomial map rather than the rational one. So it's given by omega mu, and now multiply them by n such factors, z minus z. So I want to eliminate all the poles to look at this polynomial map. I could do everything before with my p mu. It's just simpler to do it with omega mu. But now I want to consider p mu to factorize into lambda, lambda, theta. That's why I don't want to have any poles. Okay? So the fact that you have scattering, the fact that p mu square has to be zero means that this 2x2 matrix p alpha alpha dot of z, this 2x2 matrix valued map, has to have determinant zero, right? The determinant has to vanish. So this actually means that it can factorize into two spinner maps, lambda alpha of z and lambda alpha dot, lambda tilde alpha dot of z, where both of them are spinners. Okay? So in you can do the same for omega mu, but it's better to stick to the polynomial. So that is to say that our map from a sphere to a light cone of momentum space, really in 4D, they become two maps, two spinner maps. You can have a map from your CP1 to the lambda space and a map to the lambda tilde space. Okay? And there's something very nice about this polynomial form in the following sense that this P mu is a degree n minus 2 polynomial. So I leave it also as an exercise that you can check. I mean, it's very trivial. It's very similar to our softer limit argument that naively we think it's a degree n minus 1 polynomial because you have n factors canceling only one denominators. But actually the leading coefficient vanish again. So it's actually a degree n minus 2 polynomial. That means when this 2x2 matrix, each component is a degree n minus 2 polynomial, when it factorizes into this way, it means that these two are polynomials of degree d and d tilde that add up to n minus 2. Okay, so this is really the specialty about 4D. In general dimension, if you study our scattering equation, you find n minus 3 factorial solutions, they are just generic. You don't see any way of, say, grouping them into different, so the degree n minus 3 factorial polynomial never factorize. They don't become some smaller degree polynomials. But here, something special happened. You already see. This general polynomial of degree n minus 2, when you try to factorize it into lambda, lambda, tilde, you have to give me the degree of lambda and lambda, tilde as polynomial maps, right? And there can be many possibilities. So d actually can run from 1 all the way to n minus 3, while d tilde, which is the n minus 2 minus d, can run from n minus 3 back to 1. So this is the range of this degrees of the spinner maps. And this is the origin of why you have some factors in 4D. So when you study scattering equation in general dimension, all the n minus 3 factorial solutions come together. But when you study it in 4D, so your Mandelstams are given by the spinners, you know, in 4D. They are given by momenta in 4D. Then the solutions fall into sectors labeled by this d or d tilde. So there are all together -3 such sectors. Okay? So you already know two of the special sectors, right? You know this D equals one sector. You also know this D tilde equals one sector. They are the MHV and MHV bar solution that we talked about before, because they have degree one map. What is the degree one map? Degree one map means a map from Z to lambda alpha of Z, which is proportional to 1 and Z, right? And degree, this is D equals 1. D tilde equals 1 means a degree 1 map to lambda tilde. So these are the two special solutions you learned from before. This is MHV solution and this is MHV bar solution. But we have seen that there are these middle guys. There are many, many more solutions. And we know that because altogether we should have n-3 factorial solution. That still hasn't changed. Okay? So what are these solutions? So in principle, you still need to solve all those solutions, and let's just first count them, okay, as we count the n-3 factorial solution before. So actually there's a identity, quite interesting combinatoric identity, that n-3 factorial equals this d from 1 to n-3 of Eulerian number n-3 and d minus 1. So what is this Eulerian number? It has a combinatoric interpretation as counting, so basically the Eulerian number pq counts the number of permutations of 1, 2 to p with q ups, if you want. So what do I mean by q ups? So if you have a permutation 1, 2, 3, permutation 1, 2, 3 that just looks like this, it has two increase, right? If you draw it, yeah. From 1 to 2, it increases. From 2 to 3, also increase. So this number of ups is just 2. And for 1, 3, 2 is 1, right? You can count this. So that's really saying that the permutation of this altogether, you have p factorial of them, can be divided into many sectors according to how many ups you have. So let's just give you this example. At 4 point, you have one solution. This is both MHV and MHV bar. At 5 point, you have two solutions. It's given by MHV plus MHV bar. At 6 point, you have six solutions now. This is given by one MHV solution, one MHV bar solution, and four next to MHV solution. So these are exactly the counting the number of permutations that has one up, two up, and three ups. And for 7 point, you already have 1 plus 11 plus 11 plus 1. These are the Eulerian number of your 7 point, and so on. So always you have the number of scattering, the solution of our scattering equations altogether n-3 factorial of them. They fall into different sectors depending on the degree of your map. And you always have MHV, MHV bar solution on the boundary, and in the middle there are other solutions. So these sectors of the solution actually is in one-to-one correspondence with this helicity sectors. We explained before. You have next to MHV, n squared MHV, and so on. So there's actually this helicity K charge. It counts the number of negative gluons. It's actually equals to D plus 1. Okay, so when you have D equals 1 MHV, you have two negative gluons. That's the MHV case. And when you have D equals 2, it's K equals 3, which three negative guys is next to MHV case, and so on. Okay, so this is really what I want to explain as the what's special about 4D, that scattering equation fall into different sectors and they become this this map of they become the mapping to the light cone of the 4D momentum space become mapping to the spinners. And let me just write down the formula for you that if you start with our Yamuth formula with scattering equation in general dimension, now you do this trick of reducing it to 4D, what do you end up with? This is the Witten's twisted string formula. I don't have time to derive it for you, but I hope this explanation is already give you some idea why in 4D it's special, right? You start to really to classify all the solutions according to the sectors. Okay, So in the end, you reach at a formula for the N gluon scattering. For example, this is the partial amplitude of your young mu's in 4D. And now you have something more to specify. It's not just you give me this partial amplitude. You have to tell me out of here, there are two sets, sets of negative helicity guys and a set of positive helicity guys. The union of them, of course, give me all the gluons. So you have to also give me this N and P here. Okay, so there's a formula for each division of your external gluons into negative and positive helicity case in 4D. So this is the thing happening in 4D. As I already reminded you, this number of negative helicity guy is this K, which is D plus 1. And number of positive helicity guy is this N minus 2 minus K, which is D tilde plus 1.
Does that make sense?
Yes. N minus K, sorry. N minus K. Yeah, they add up to N. Sorry. Okay. So the D dimension scattering equation now fall into sectors labeled by the number of negative and positive helicity guys. Okay? And what's the formula look like? The formula is very simple. Now you just have in addition to the punctures, the inhomogeneous coordinate, you actually now also have its scale. Because in 4D there's this little group GL1. So altogether you have this D2N integral of your sigma. And here you need to mod out the gauge group GL2, which is given by your original SL2 times a GL1, which is the little group in 4D. And you still have the Park Taylor there. As I record here, 1, 2, 2, 3 to N1. I'll explain the notation immediately. And I use a label capital I to denote all the particles in the negative set. They have a delta function of this form, lambda tilde I plus summing over I in the positive set, lambda tilde I. And more delta functions for guys in the positive set that I use a small I to denote, positive helicity guys, lambda I minus capital lambda I, summing over I. Capital lambda I just runs from the negative guys. Okay, sorry that goes too far. So this is a formula that you reduce from your D dimension gluon scattering into 4 dimension. Because it falls into sectors, so it actually simplifies a lot. The Fafian, the whole Fafian just goes away. You didn't see any Fafian, right? So the reason is actually very, very interesting because when you turn, yeah, let me first explain the notation. Here the sigmas are given by, the sigmas are 2 by 2 component that's given by the inhomogeneous coordinate. So this ZA is what we had before, right? With this scale. And this is the GL1, the little group of the theory. And here when you have this 2 bracket AB, it's the 2 bracket of sigma A and sigma B, which is simply TA, TB times the ZA minus ZB. So this Park Taylor is essentially our original Park Taylor, but now it has its scale in it. So I'm just turning in 4D, I'm just turning everything into the homogeneous coordinate. And you notice that the Fafian goes away. And can you see why? The reason is very simple, because originally we had a scattering equation that doesn't know about any sector, any negative or positive helicity gluons. Now we will reduce to 4D. As we showed here, the sectors start to appear. All the solutions fall into these different sectors. And the Fafian actually also knows about this. So when you plug in, say, a MHV solution, it's only non-vanishing for the MHV helicity configuration. If you plug in a next to MHV sector solution, like this 4 solutions here, it only knows about the, it's only non-vanishing for the next to MHV helicity configuration. So the Fafian actually cancels the change of the Jacobian from this change of variable, this rewriting of the delta function from our original scattering equation to this set of scattering equation. And what are these? These are basically 2k dot functions that impose some linear dependence of your lambda tildes. And here is the 2 times n minus k dot functions that impose some linear dependence of your lambdas with coefficient given by our 2 brackets, right? So this is I won't have time to derive this for you, but this is exactly what you obtained when you reduce the scattering equation to 4D. And they are, this is the formula. This is a slightly rewritten formula of the famous Witten Roybaum's Brodling Volovich formula in 4D. I think it's 2004. And we see that it comes out naturally from scattering equation when you plug in the gluons having positive or negative helicity configurations. Okay, so the last thing I want to just briefly mention is that this is a formula that you can also, from here, you can also directly jump to a formula called Grassmannian formula, which actually also gives you all the tree amplitudes in Yamil's theory, but also tells you some more about this object appearing loop amplitude, basically the maximal cuts of the loop amplitude, so-called leading singularity, at least in the planar n equals 4, in the planar n equals 4 super Yamil's case. So I won't talk about any detail of that, but just you should already see this from the from this formula. Okay, so let's just have a geometric interpretation of this delta function. What do they really mean? I mean, I told you that they come from the scattering equation when you reduce to 4D, but they can actually be written in a very nice form. So for example, this delta function on lambda tilde, I can write them as CIA. This A runs for particle labels, A from 1 to n of lambda tilde A equals 0, right? This delta function can be interpreted like this. And this one is simply the orthogonal complement of this matrix. I call it C perp of small I, because it has the small I that runs from all the negative guys on lambda A that equals 0. So this two sets of delta functions actually imply this equations where your C is a K by N matrix that have this form. So for the, say let's already fix this N to be 1, 2 to K, okay? This is just a simple choice. And this P to be K plus 1 to N. It doesn't really matter, but I just want to show you the matrix. So that's why I fixed it to be 1 to K. And you see that this lambda I tilde has coefficient 1 from here. So this is an identity matrix, K by K matrix here. Okay, this is, C is meant to be a K by N matrix. Here you have K rows and N columns. So for the first N for the first K columns, it's just an identity matrix. And for the remaining, it just looks like this, 1 over 1 K plus 1, all the way to 1 over 1 N. And the last one is 1 over K plus 1. All the way to 1 over kn. Okay, so this is the matrix of that entering this linear dependence of lambda tilde in the delta function. And the one for lambda is just its orthogonal complement, that C perp is a n minus k by n matrix. That actually looks like, again, an identity matrix of n minus k guys. And the rest is just a this piece with a minus sign. So these two guys, C dot C perp equals 0. Okay? So what we did here is we really just rewrite a little bit this delta function into a K by N matrix and its complement. So what is momentum conservation really saying here? Momentum conservation is encoded in this constraint as the following. So your lambda tilde, if you view it as a 2 by n matrix, is actually a 2 plane in your n dimensional space formed by, so your n dimensional space is labeled by this particle 1, 2 to n. And since you have the spinner lambda tilde, each particle has a 2 component spinner. It forms a 2 by n matrix which you can view as a 2 plane, this lambda tilde plane. in this n-dimensional space, right? So C dot lambda tilde equals zero here is basically seeing that there's a C, which is a K-band matrix, which is a K-plane. And we already see there's a GLK redundancy that we can use to do this gauge fixing. So there's a K-plane that is orthogonal to your two-plane, right? In this n-dimensional space called C. And this is saying that the orthogonal of this C is again orthogonal to another two-plane, which is your lambda plane. So if you think about it, it just means that this C actually contains your lambda plane, right? This condition, the orthogonal of your C is orthogonal to your lambda. So the whole constraint, this dot function, is implying that there is a K-plane C that contains lambda plane and orthogonal to a lambda tilde plane. So lambda dot lambda tilde must be zero. They must be orthogonal as well. So this is the momentum conservation. You're summing over, because it's an n-dimensional space relation, you're summing over all the particles at zero. So what do Arkani Hamid and friends realized a few years ago is that this way of realizing momentum conservation, of making linear relations rather than quadratic relations here, is very useful. And you can simply plug it in and upgrade this part of your measure to a Grassmannian measure that I it's just instead of this 2 by n matrix, you have this k by n matrix C, and you have a GLK redundancy instead, and you have this minor, which is not 2 by 2, but now k by k, n 1, k minus 1. Everything else doesn't need to be changed. So you just upgrade this measure part from a 2 by n, because we start from a sphere. And after you include the GL1, it's a GL2 measure. Now you upgrade it to GLK, depending on your helicity sector, and you just copy this part that you have a delta C lambda tilde delta square and another product of delta square C perp dot lambda equals zero. So you just use this linear dependency of lambda lambda tilde, which actually linearizes your momentum conservation condition, and you put the Grassmannian measure here. This actually gives you the tree amplitude almost. Except there's a problem. The problem is that this has way too many integrals to do, right? Right here we have 2n minus 4 integrals and 2n minus 4 delta function, because although you may look at this as 2n delta function, there are 4 of them is just momentum conservation condition, so you model them out. Here you have k times n minus k function, so this is actually a contour integral. You have to specify the contour. So by doing this, they're actually able to specify that not only there's a specific contour that brings you back to this form, which give you the BCFW recursion relation form of the tree amplitudes, but actually each residue here has some interpretation as loop level cuts of n equals 4 superambiguous theory. Okay, so I'll just end my lectures here. Thank you.